Hey everybody, Marcus here. Stardust put out a video not too long ago discussing the notion of the Red Pill Woman. The Red Pill Woman can be understood as someone who has encountered and sufficiently absorbed MGTOW information. Now, the premises of Stardust's video can be roughly summarized in a few bullet points. 1. All women are like that. 2. MGTOW knowledge cannot transform a woman. 3. MGTOW knowledge is disempowering to women. 4. MGTOW knowledge can only be used by women to build a better man trap. And 5. Genetically related males can have immunity to the wiles of women's nature. Now, Stardust's video came out while I was drafting the script for this video that you are listening to now, as the subject matter Stardust presented has some overlap with what I intend to discuss. I will use the opportunity to address his premises as part of my overarching argument. The topic of my video is simple. I believe it is in the best interest of all men to educate women in MGTOW knowledge. I'm going to put forward 3 arguments to justify this position. The first will dive into the metaphysical nature of knowledge and its relationship to justice. The second argument will cover the topic of child rearing. And finally, the third argument will cover courtship. So, let's get started. In the first book of the Republic, Socrates is locked in argument with a few different interlocutors. The subject of the conversation is justice. Each interlocutor offers their own definition of justice. And, you know, in his typical manner, Socrates puts each definition up against the Elenchus. One of these interlocutors is named Polymarchus. Now, the definition of justice that Polymarchus puts forward goes as follows. Justice is the art that treats friends well who are good and harms an enemy who is bad. So, we can ask ourselves, is it the role of the just man to harm anyone? Well, it may be said that it would be, namely, that it would be the just man's role to harm those who are both bad and enemies. But, let us consider this. Do horses become better or worse when they are harmed? Well, surely they become worse. But in what respect? With respect to the virtue that makes dogs good or the one that makes horses good? Well, surely with respect to the virtue that makes horses good. And in this way, too, when dogs are harmed, they become worse in the virtue that makes dogs good, not horses. But can the same thing not be said about humans? Then, when humans are harmed, they are made worse in human virtue. Well, this definitely can be said to be true. But, isn't justice human virtue? Well, it is. So, people who are harmed must then become more unjust. Well, and that's the way it would seem. Now, can musicians make people unmusical through music? Well, surely they cannot. Or, can horsemen make people unhorsemanlike through horsemanship? Well, this too cannot be done. What about this then? Can those who are just make people unjust through justice? No, they cannot. Is it not the function of heat to cool things, but of its opposite? Well, yes, this is true. Nor the function of dryness to make things wet, but of its opposite? Well, this is true too. Nor the function of goodness to harm, but of its opposite. Again, true. And is a just person good? Well, surely he is. Then it isn't the function of a just person to harm a friend or anyone else. Rather, it is the function of his opposite, an unjust person. So, through this argument, Socrates has shown Polymarchus that to harm anyone is to make them worse in human virtue. As justice is a virtue, to harm others is to make them more unjust. As justice cannot bring about its opposite, it must be concluded that to harm anyone is to act unjustly. Now, is knowledge not the opposite of ignorance? Well, surely it is. Is it also not the case that knowledge is better to ignorance? Again, true. So, either knowledge is good and ignorance bad, or ignorance is good and knowledge is bad. As we have stated that knowledge is better than ignorance, It must be the case, then, that knowledge is good and ignorance bad. If knowledge is good, and it has been previously argued that a thing cannot lead to its opposite, then it follows that knowledge leads to the good, while ignorance to the bad, and neither to their opposite. So, what this argument means is that knowledge always makes you better and never worse, while ignorance always makes you worse and never better. If this is to be accepted, then can it also be said that to intentionally contribute to someone's ignorance is to make them worse? Well, indeed it can. And to make someone worse is to do them harm? Well, this too is true. So we must then conclude that to intentionally contribute to someone's ignorance is to do them harm. As we have earlier shown that to do anyone harm is to do injustice, it necessarily follows that it is unjust to intentionally contribute to someone's ignorance. Another conclusion that can be also drawn from this argument is that intentionally keeping knowledge from someone is to make them more unjust. From this argument, we must conclude that keeping red pill knowledge from women would be injustice on the part of men. The second conclusion is that attempts to keep red pill knowledge from women can only contribute to creating women who are more unjust. So, on metaphysical grounds, it would follow that educating women in red pill knowledge will create more just women. It, you know, may be difficult to see how this plays itself out in the real world, but I hope that my next two arguments help give an exposition to this end. The second argument is focused around child rearing. Now, it is not controversial to say that women overwhelmingly can be found in positions of influence on children. This can be observed starting with maternity leave, to the growing trend of single mothers, and finally to the almost absolute dominion of women in primary schools. As such, early development of children can be posited as the dominion of women. Now, are there more than one type of relations between males and females? Well, surely there are. After all, women and men can have a relation of friendship, that of siblings, that of aunt and uncle, that of grandmother and grandfather, that of mother and father, that of lover, girlfriend or boyfriend, and of course, wife and husband. Now, of these relations, two categories emerge. In the first case, we have relations that bind by blood. These relations we group under the name of family. In the second case, we have all non-blood relations, of which all have romantic potential, you know, with friendship being a type that can immediately precede sexual interaction. Okay, let us once again adopt the argument I have used in many other of my videos. Women are hedonistic by nature. Therefore, they seek to minimize pain and maximize pleasure. Now, can it not be said that pleasure, then, is to a woman's interest? Well, indeed, this can be said. So in this way, pain would be to her detriment. And this is true too. So it then follows that a woman would seek to maximize her interest while minimizing her detriment. Now, do women want what is best for their children? At face value, you know, we would like to answer in the affirmative. We would like to say that, yes, women want what is best for their children. However, I do not believe this to be the case. Also, this should not be construed to imply the opposite either. I am not suggesting women want what is worst for their children, no. To demonstrate what I mean, we will need to go into some exposition. Firstly, if women wanted what is best for their children as a matter of course, there would be no infanticide, sex-selected abortion, nor would there be abortion of any sort. In addition to this, there would be no parental alienation or the use of children as weapons in custody battles. Indeed, these things would not exist. But they do exist. Since these phenomena exist, there must be an account that explains these phenomena. Now, can it not be observed that in each of the examples I have cited, there's a conflict of interest? Namely, a conflict of interest between the woman and her child. Well, indeed, this is common to each of the examples cited. Now, this makes sense and logically follows from what we have argued before. If indeed women will maximize their interest and minimize their detriment, and a conflict between the interest of the woman and the interest of the child ensues, She will maximize her own interests and not the child's. Okay, but what about cases where there is no conflict of interest between the child and the mother? Well, it can be said that the mother will still be maximizing her own interests in respect of the child. So, what would be in the interest of the mother? Well, health. As a healthy child is less work and upkeep than a sickly child, maximizing a child's health is in the interest of the mother. In addition to health, we can see that education of the child would follow. Having a poor performing child would be a source of shame to the mother and therefore pain. Therefore, the education of the child would also need to be maximized. And so in this way, many aspects of the child's upbringing and development can be argued for. But where the mother has been maximizing her interests through maximizing things we would attribute as beneficial to the child itself, you know, health and education, so too would the mother wish to minimize detriment in the life of the child that somehow either maximizes her interest or minimizes her detriment. First, let us posit that the child is male. Now, the spousification of male children among single mothers has been previously documented within the MGTOW community. Now, the phenomenon of spousification has been described as a mother imposing on her male offspring roles and responsibilities similar to what she would expect from a husband, these responsibilities falling short of incest. Okay, if indeed the spousification is occurring between a mother and her son, then it follows that the mother would fear losing her son to another woman. Now, I posit that that fear can be partially observed in the concept of a mother's love, as well as the conflict that tends to arise between a wife and her mother-in-law. And finally, the notion of normalizing incest as outlined in the work of Andrea Dworkin's. If we accept these premises, then we can conclude that the mother would tell cautionary tales to her son about women while elevating the image of herself in the eyes of her son. Let us take a look at the concept of the gold digger for a moment. A woman who is a gold digger is often maximizing deference from a man. Now, gold digging is beneficial to women, namely, well, the gold digger, and detrimental to the man. However, a mother would warn her son against gold diggers. If she does not warn her son, then, well, you know, at least it can surely be said that she would not advocate that her son find himself a gold digger. The mother herself may be a gold digger, and she may promote gold digging to her daughter, but never recommend her son pursue a gold digger. But why would a mother warn her son of bad female behavior, such as gold digging? Well, clearly two things are the case. Firstly, there is no conflict of interest between the mother and her son as her son's choice in selecting a romantic partner. In the second case, it must be in her interest to discourage her son from pursuing gold diggers. Now, what can be in the mother's interest driving her to discourage her son from pursuing a gold digger? Well, if her son ends up with such a woman, then the son will be fleeced of his resources without qualification. If the son is fleeced in such a way, then it may become the case that he will have nothing to help support the mother if needed. In addition, a gold digger is less likely to produce grandchildren, which, in turn, would mean her son would have less resources to attract the woman who would produce grandchildren. Finally, even if a gold digger would produce grandchildren, it can be inferred that there is a risk that she would leave the father for someone with more wealth. If this is the case, then the mother would surely lose some, if not all, access to her grandchildren. Now, the concept of the gold digger is not a new concept. It has been around for decades, if not from the dawn of time. I mean, this concept is also considered to be almost exclusively a female quality. And finally, it is considered negative. So, a gold digger can be understood as a negative female-only behavior. Now, how does the concept of the gold digger differ from a concept such as hypergamy? Well, I would wager that hypergamy is considered by MGTOW as, well, universal, whereas gold digging, well, may not, at least not under the conventional interpretation of a gold digger. Now, no MGTOW content maker, well, to my knowledge, has ever done a video warning men of gold diggers. I suspect this to be the case because the concept of the gold digger is common knowledge among men. You know, a concept that someone tells you about soon after you discover women and take interest in them. The notion of the gold digger is part of the mainstream consciousness, and it is not controversial to openly condemn gold diggers by either sex. Now, if a negative female-only trait like gold digging can enter the mainstream consciousness, then it should be possible for other concepts such as hypergamy to do the same. Earlier, we argued that child education is the dominion of women. As women warn their sons of gold diggers, then it surely must be possible to add hypergamy to the list of things mothers warn their sons about. If mothers begin to warn their sons of hypergamy, then awareness of hypergamy will quickly spread into the mainstream consciousness and become common knowledge, you know, just as the gold digger has. Though I do not plan to make the argument in this video, something similar can be said about the concept of the wall. Though younger mothers may be less than accepting of this concept, a postmenopausal woman, I would posit, would have little problems in broaching such an idea with her granddaughters. You know, in fact, I would be surprised if older women do not already understand a version of this phenomenon. You know, perhaps the wall has been wrapped up in the idea of the old maid or spinster and simply forgotten. So, our second argument can be summarized in the following way. As women are the primary influencers on child development, then they are a great medium through which MGTOW concepts can propagate to children. As women seem to have no problem in warning their sons of exclusively female negative behaviors, such as gold digging, then it should be possible to introduce other such phenomenon into the list of things mothers warn their sons about. Finally, the incentive for mothers to warn their sons of things like hypergamy is in the best interest of the mother. This in turn means that men learning MGTOW knowledge cannot be disempowering to women, at least not to those who have sons. Now, our victory would be in elevating the term hypergamy into the mainstream consciousness. It would not be necessary that the details of the term are fully communicated. I mean, for example, it is almost certain that a NAWALT disclaimer would follow the concept of hypergamy. But once the phenomenon has been elevated to the level of language, individual men will figure out the rest on their own. You know, sometimes you just need to know what to Google for. Of course, the vector of injecting such an idea into the mainstream would, well, inevitably need to be wrapped in some epidemic targeting women. I mean, perhaps the epidemic of grandmothers losing access to their grandchildren with hypergamy as a leading cause. Well, but, you know, this is out of scope of this video. Now, my third and last argument is focused around courtship. Stardust argued that women learning MGTOW knowledge might help women in improving their ability to trap men. So let us evaluate this argument and see where it takes us. First, let us set out some terms. Those women who have been versed in red pill knowledge, well, let us call them red pill women. Inversely, a woman who has not been versed in red pill knowledge, well, let us call her a blue pill woman. In this same way, let us distinguish between the red pill and the blue pill man. Now we have four actors: the blue pill woman, the red pill woman, the blue pill man, and the red pill man. With these distinctions in place, we can see that there are only four possible combinations in interacting. 1. The blue pill woman and the blue pill man. 2. The blue pill woman and the red pill man. 3. The red pill woman and the blue pill man. 4. The red pill woman and the red pill man. Now, a red pill man will have already come to the conclusion that NAWALT do not exist. As such, no argument offered by either a blue pill or red pill woman should have the ability to convince him otherwise. So, it follows that red pill knowledge cannot in any way help a woman in her advances on a red pill man. This means that two of the four possible interactions can safely be removed from our concern of women using red pill knowledge to build a better man trap. Next, we can look at the blue pill woman making advances towards a blue pill man. As the blue pill woman has no red pill knowledge, it cannot be said that she would have any benefit from Red Pill knowledge in helping her snare a man. This means that there's only one possible interaction left where women could possibly gain an advantage over men by possessing Red Pill knowledge. The interaction between a Red Pill woman and a Blue Pill man. It can be argued that a Blue Pill man will already have a pedestalized view of women. As such, he will not be putting forward reservations concerning Red Pill subjects. For example, our Blue Pill man will not be checking for hypergamy, nor will he be aware of the wall or male mother need. Now, if this Blue Pill man is not throwing out such concerns, then it follows that a Red Pill woman would never find herself in need of defending herself as a NAWALT for these issues. After all, the Blue Pill man is not making any AWALT claims. If this is the case, then her Red Pill knowledge will in no way give her an edge in defending against AWALT arguments. It will never come up. The Blue Pill man will be, you know, filtering on typical Blue Pill criteria, such as, you know, common interests, looks, sense of humor, intelligence, and, you know, whatever else is his personal preference. In fact, if the woman puts forward any claims of being a NAWALT by mentioning things like hypergamy, then she would have actually introduced Red Pill knowledge to the man, which in turn would not serve her interests. If bringing up hypergamy would not serve her interests, then it would follow that she would stay silent about any Red Pill knowledge she might have. Now, this does not mean that Red Pill knowledge would not help her snare this man. What we have argued so far means that her Red Pill knowledge would never manifest itself in a conversation with a man. Okay, what about Red Pill knowledge benefiting her secretly? What about the idea of her using Red Pill knowledge to change her tactics when dealing with men in order to get better results? Could Red Pill knowledge help a woman change her tactics? Well, let us investigate this possibility. If it can be said that Red Pill knowledge can confer an advantage for a woman, then it must follow that a Blue Pill woman is behaving suboptimally due to her ignorance of Red Pill knowledge. Now, is a Blue Pill woman hypergamous? Well, she is. Does a Blue Pill woman need to be aware of hypergamy in order to behave hypergamously? Well, surely not. So it follows that an absence of knowledge of hypergamy is not a hindrance to a woman behaving hypergamously. Now, what happens when a Blue Pill woman is introduced to the concept of hypergamy? Well, if she is honest in her interpretation of this concept, she will come to find a set of behaviors in her autobiography that corresponds to hypergamous behavior. So, exposing a Blue Pill woman to the concept of hypergamy simply makes a woman aware of some facet about herself that was true before she became aware of it. Awareness, however, cannot convey an advantage unless it is applied in some manner that alters her behavior. So, how can a Red Pill woman alter her behavior after coming to be aware of hypergamy? Well, will she become more hypergamous? Well, surely not, for she was as hypergamous as her environment would allow her to be before becoming aware of her hypergamy. Therefore, the only change in tactics she could make by becoming aware of hypergamy is to move away from being hypergamous. But if indeed she began to restrain her hypergamy, this cannot be seen as detrimental to a Blue Pill man. But even though knowledge of hypergamy cannot make a woman more hypergamous, perhaps it would assist her in concealing her hypergamy. Well, as our Red Pill woman is interacting with a Blue Pill man, and our Blue Pill man is unaware of hypergamy, then it would follow he is not looking for hypergamy, nor would he be able to identify hypergamy as hypergamy if he saw it. From this, it follows that our Red Pill woman would gain no special advantage in concealing her hypergamous behavior beyond what she would normally do. Even if the Blue Pill man were to catch her performing some misdeed, the misdeed itself would never be confronted as hypergamy, as our Blue Pill man is unaware of this concept. As he is unaware of this concept, he would explain the misdeed in terms of things other than hypergamy. As this is the case, the woman would need to defend herself on those terms, and not on the terms of hypergamy. So once again, elevating the conversation to red pill concepts by the red pill woman would never enter the conversation, as it is not to her advantage to introduce such terms. Now, let us take a short detour and look at the concept of a slut. Now, the concept of a slut is a pejorative slur almost exclusively leveled at women. Men use this slur, but more importantly, women use this slur as well. Now, a man may use this slur as an insult, but it has a different force in the mouth of a woman. If a woman calls another woman a slut, she is doing two things. Firstly, she is attempting to distinguish herself from the target of this slur, and therefore elevate her own standing in the eyes of the audience. In the second way, she is diminishing the standing of her target. The male equivalent would be in calling another man a pussy. I mean, after all, it is said that men do not want to date sluts and women don't want to date pussies. Now, it is this mechanism of differentiation and diminishment when a woman uses this term that provides a stronger incentive for a woman to brand another woman a slut. So, in the same way, if hypergamy became a slur, women would have incentive to launch it at each other. For example, if one woman steals the boyfriend of another woman, the victim of this action could brand the perpetrator as a hypergamous bitch, as opposed to just a bitch. I posit that if this word caught fire in the mean girls contingent of women, soon enough awareness of hypergamy would spread both among women and men. Hypergamy would be elevated to the mainstream consciousness through the mechanism that I just described, and that is the same mechanism by which the word slut has been disseminated through. Okay. But could a red pill woman benefit from the knowledge of male mother need? Would this criteria justify the concerns of Stardust in red pill knowledge giving women tools detrimental to men? Well, let's explore this idea. If male mother need is understood as some innate dependency of a man towards female validation, then it is the case that men will feel compelled to pursue and hold onto female validation. With this knowledge, a red pill woman becoming aware of male mother need would gain insights into why men show interest towards women. However, could it help her snare a man? Now, do men select for the women they wish to approach? Well, surely they do. Now, is a man approaching a woman partially influenced by male mother need? Well, surely it is. But now, is a man approaching a specific woman partially influenced from male mother need? Surely not. Therefore, though it can be said that a man will approach women partially from male mother need, it cannot be said that he is choosing the specific woman to approach as a consequence of male mother need. If this is true, then it does not follow that knowledge of male mother need can be used by a woman to alter her behavior in order to increase the number of approaches. If were the case that knowledge of male mother need could influence this outcome, then women would not dress provocatively, as men usually do not associate their mom and sex. If women dress provocatively, and women are hedonistic by nature, then it follows that provocative clothing is maximizing their interest. Women achieve results by dressing provocatively, as achieving results implies that the method of maximization is effective, then it follows that dressing provocatively is effective. Now, it is said that men gain validation from sexual conquests of attractive women. If this is the case, and the validation sought from male mother need is the same as validation from sexual conquests, then it would follow that male mother need is fulfilled by sexual conquest. I posit that male mother need is a validation of a different kind than that achieved from sexual conquest. If this is the case, then fulfillment of male mother need is different from fulfillment of sexual conquest. If dressing provocatively is meant to excite on the sexual level, and it has been argued that it is effective in attracting approaches, Then it would follow that men approach women who will validate in a way congruent with sexual conquest, and not validate on the level of male mother need. Now, if this holds true, then it follows that a lure to attract a man cannot be set on the grounds of male mother need, as a man will not select a particular woman based on male mother need. He will only be incited to approach women as a group due to male mother need. Therefore, the red pill woman cannot leverage awareness of male mother need in order to alter her behavior to snare a man. But what about controlling a man once she has snared one? Can knowledge of male mother need help the red pill woman control a man? Well, before we answer this, let us explicitly call out what we have implicitly implied by this question. We have implicitly implied that a woman is already aware that she can control a man, and also that she has a desire to do so. If this is the case, then it follows that red pill knowledge was not needed to make her aware that mechanisms exist through which women can control men. As male mother need presents an exploitable mechanism through which control can be achieved, it would follow that exposing a woman to knowledge of male mother need would indeed help a woman in controlling men. However, if this is the case, then it follows that such a woman, previous to exposure to the concept of male mother need, did not know that male desire for female validation was an exploitable quality in men. Now let me ask you this. What woman with any meaningful experience with men is not aware that validation is something women can exploit in men? I would posit that no woman is this ignorant. So, if such a woman had already been aware of a woman's ability to exploit validation, then it follows that exposure to the concept of male mother need will add no further insight. In truth, exposing a woman to the concept of male mother need will only give an account of why exploitation of validation works. As exposure of the concept of male mother need adds no further pragmatic information to a red pill woman's repertoire, it would follow that a red pill woman's awareness of this phenomenon is only topical. After all, she will still need to figure out how to exploit this behavior. Awareness alone will not teach her any tricks. Though other red pill ideas could be dissected in this manner, I believe that we will come to the same conclusion for each of them. Either red pill ideas benefit women personally by making them better people, or they benefit men by providing a roadmap for women to be better partners, or have no impact on a malicious woman's knowledge of how to exploit men. They simply give names to why her exploits work. And this makes sense and naturally follows from what we have demonstrated in the first argument. Knowledge cannot make someone worse, especially self-knowledge. And with this, well, I close my third argument. Now, to sum it all up, encouraging women to taste of red pill knowledge can only serve to benefit men and women alike. To justify this, I offered three arguments. In the first argument, we concluded that knowledge can only make better, and it would be unjust to contribute to someone's ignorance. In the second argument, we concluded that it should be possible for red pill knowledge to get disseminated through the pedagogical influence that women have on children. And finally, in the third argument, we showed that a red pill woman could only hope to gain an edge on a blue pill man. But when explored deeper, it turned out that no such advantage could be found. Thanks for listening. Go team.